terms of being a Westerner, all the stories that I was raised on and have sought as an adult woman seem to begin in St. Louis, you know, and then they trudge forward. And I'm going to read mostly from this book, The Book of Seeing with One's Own Eyes, which is stories, prose. I'm going to read because I'm a poet and I can't pull off reading a whole story. I'm going to read fragments like poetry, for the most part, from this book. I'm going to read at least one section from this book, El Niño, and I'll tell you a secret. Originally, these were one manuscript. Everybody says that's too much. You got to cut it. So I cut it. Now I have two books. In this story, this is from the first story. It's called Ramon Ramona. The narrator is living in northeastern San Diego County. It's a town called Ramona. And her first love is named Ramon, and he's a Mojave Indian. The summer is dark and green here in Angel Park. Ramon and I have been swimming, our bodies alive from hours in the cold water. We come down the hill beneath eucalyptus, sycamore. He says, let's sit down here for a while. We lie in the deep, cool grass within a half circle of pink and white oleander bushes. We are talking, words we don't hear. I am lying on my belly. His hand is moving between my breasts and the grass. My surprise is deep, real, both in that he has done this and in the way it feels. I have prepared for years not to be seduced, but this isn't what I thought it would be. I'm prepared in my mind, in my will. This is different. This is my body. His fingers on my breast feel like rivets, the reverberations cutting deep down through me. The nipple grows like a small tower. I'm afraid he'll quit what he's doing. Ramon, I know nothing about female orgasm, but across the park I am moving deep into the ground, vaguely aware of a figure walking down the tree-lined path, praying no one sees us until the green of the park has become the color of the sun setting, corals and pinks, streaks of violent red, and my pounding, insisting heart trying to reach through to his fingers, to push the tower, the blood, the trees, myself, through to him. Ramon, Ramon, trying to drown with my blood forever the enormous and boring time of childhood. This is from the next story, which is entitled Raquel. I read two sections from this. And I guess I should tell you beforehand that this is a the narrator in that story was 13. As difficult as it is to write, to think, to speak, and to listen, maybe hardest of all, to listen to some of the themes that I write about and the issues I write about, it has seemed to me really important to try and write from a female point of view about sex, because it's not that it hasn't been done before, but in the literature it is fairly new, and there's so many misconceptions. Raquel in the story turns out to be Raquel Welch. The narrator is in a beauty contest in which Raquel Welch is one of three judges. At this point, the narrator is still 13, and she's being told by everybody in town that she will be the eventual Miss Ramona, that she's a beauty queen, and she's very confused about this and very disturbed by it. So again, San Diego County, the town is Ramona. It is June, my first in Ramona, in the country. The temperature hovers in the mid-80s. Most days are overcast, breaths of steam rising off the giant boulders. I descend the path through the sagebrush, down over the granite slabs that cover half the hill, down to Olive Road, the one olive tree shaking insecurely like a gray old man on a cane in the sunset. The smell of the sage and the granite is pungent, wild. As the sun goes down, the full moon rises. I hate Ramona. I long for asphalt, traffic lights, city kids. My parents took me from my birthplace, which was Los Angeles. They took me from Sarah. They say over and over it was too dangerous. They were afraid of the Friday marijuana raids on the lockers at Los Amigos. They were afraid when Linda Allen had a baby at 12. I keep trying to tell them it's wilder in Ramona. The boys in my class are already alcoholics. They think only of sex. I can't convince them. My parents think people in the country are innocent. The rocks, as I walk down in the twilight to get the evening paper, breathe and twist and discover me. When they do this, I lose who I am. I lose my hatred to a beauty that's turned around from all I'm being told is beautiful. The smell of the land is stark, like courage. I don't want to be Miss Angel. I want to be this road I'm walking now, this sudden drop from Olive, down past Giant's grave, the mound-shaped hill Mama always says she could make disappear if she had faith as a grain of mustard seed. If you have faith, the mountain shall be removed. Nothing shall be impossible. And then she'd have a view of town. Down around the tight snake loops, curling the spilled granite, past Mrs. Henderson's, a woman who lives alone in the grove of pepper trees. Why are old women who live alone frightening? I'm bored. I know so much more than anyone wants me to know. But there's nothing to do with my knowledge. The sage, not so thick as on the hill, but more fierce, seems in need of me, a need which as I pass is less and less. At the paved crossroads, a smile from the house. A mile from the house, I get the newspaper from the mailbox. Miss La Jolla wins Miss Ferris of the Fair. Her photograph is in the left-hand corner of the front page of the San Diego Tribune. She is at the center of her royal court, a dark girl in a white ruffle gown. Her princesses surround her. Pat is not one of them. Her name is Raquel Tejada. She is 17 and a senior at La Jolla High School. I start the climb back up in the hot twilight. Venus, the one star I know, is setting. The full moon, though it is still not dark, is rising behind my shoulder, behind Ramona, the granite woman lying as the mountain horizon, who will rise again, they say, and with her the Indians, whose land this is. Behind her, Mexico, always purple when visible, and Raquel Tejada, the queen. I've been studying the photographs of beauty queens, but they keep meshing into the same woman. This photograph is different. A white rose behind her ear, her long, dark, curly hair. I wonder who she really is. Is she like Pat? Is she a real queen? The photograph pulls me like the sage pulls me. I'm 13. I'm awakening in the deepest part of myself to the world, what it wants, what it thinks. Sage, soil, rocks, sky, people, society, stars. I'm trying to understand the politics of beauty, how it works. The steps. From here, you must go there to be acclaimed the fairest. The path is open to me if I want to take it. My mother's instructions in the power of positive thinking is a great advantage, but I'm in excruciating pain for my ugliness greater than my faith. Ugly, ugly as an old witch. Sometimes I catch myself in the bathroom mirror, and I am beautiful, like the body of Marilyn Monroe on the calendar that hung over Daddy's workbench in the garage in Los Angeles. Sometimes I catch myself in the bathroom mirror, climbing out of the tub, and I am an ugly old woman, uglier than Snow White's cruel stepmother. At school, I read the National Geographic. The Chinese bind women's feet. The Ubangis stretch their lips. The West Africans stretch their necks. The Incas, their earlobes. Some people make scars on their bodies to be beautiful, and tattoos, and some people think fat is beautiful. One day you wear a flannel shirt, and they don't see you. You can stand a long time in the grocery line before he waits on you. The next day you walk in wearing the clothes you've bought from your first job, your new lipstick, or you can just laugh in your old flannel in such a way that the grocer will be rude to the middle-aged man in front of you, or anyone, your mother, the school principal. It is so clearly a game, one all people in their choice of being ugly, beautiful, or in between must know. But then there is my mother, so beautiful, but so apart from this game. She does nothing to be beautiful. She just is herself, what she is. No exaggeration, no effort to exist outside herself. Is there real beauty, I keep wondering, apart from what we learn? Is there real ugliness? In the moonlight, Raquel Tejada's features are hardly visible. It's not her beauty I'm fascinated by. There's something in the photograph itself. When I get back to the house, I study the picture in the dining room light. And this is later, and this is in the middle of the Miss Ramona contest. She does get hooked into doing it. So let's see. At this point, this is 3 years later, and Raquel is now Raquel Welch, although not the Raquel Welch we know. She's married and had two babies. In fact, this is a week or so after the birth of her second baby. And it's sort of embarrassing because everybody considers her a has-been. And the contest has happened, the prancing before the judges. And then there's an intermission, and while the judges try and figure out who's won before the announcement. I'll tell you, because I'm not going to read it, I'll tell you now that the narrator comes in last place. And two things. Bridget is the narrator's sister who appears all the way through the two books. And there's two photographs described in this picture. The Book of Seeing with One's Own Eyes, you may know the etymology of the word autopsy is seeing with one's own eyes. And film is one of the major theme in this book, all the way through, the effect of film on us as 20th century folks. Anyway, there's two photographs, and both of them, I always thought that one of them would be the cover for this book. It didn't turn out to be that way. The first one is the one of Marilyn Monroe and Jane Mansfield, and the second one is of the narrator and Raquel. Anyway, I move out of the bathroom into the dark corner behind the throng of people. The band is playing Mood Indigo. Raquel Welch is standing in front of me. She's just standing there in her ill-fitting blue gown, small and unglamorous, thinking no one is looking at her. Light doesn't spark off her as it does the girls in the contest, as I can see it coming off me. The nostrils of her thick nose flare with each breath. She really is, as everyone sneers, Mexican. But I love the dark, the earth. She had a baby 2 weeks ago, her second baby. She has milk. I'm sucked into her as into a cave, the hole so visible from their recent birth. Why are you wearing a dress that's too large? Maybe you almost died. Bridget comes through the crowd to take a picture of me. She recognizes Raquel and takes it of her instead. Raquel Tejada, she emotes with a flashbulb, and instantly the dark, sullen figure becomes sparkling light. But too late for the photograph, and before world fame, before plastic surgery, age and film make you large, before Silicon, before Italy, before the starry debut, before the great actress, you stand in front of the old photographs of my hometown, a stagecoach on dusty Main, the army with Kit Carson the day before the massacre, Nuevo printed in white ink above your head. I'm a white ghost behind you, Miss Angel in her turkey feathers. Your hair is cropped, your head too small, you are too small, sinking the deadly vortex, your mother a wetback maid for the rich, into her you must sink. Be a fading beauty at 20, acquiesce to anonymity, live on this earth through the lives of your children, be smoke, not flames, postpartum blues, you are a woman being removed from the world. Along with her camera, Bridget is carrying a copy of The Valley of the Dolls by Jacqueline Suzanne. Are you reading that book too? Raquel asks. Oh, yes, I can't put it down. My sister can be chums with anyone. My mother gave it to me while I was in the hospital, Raquel says. My mother's so dumb, she thinks because it shows Hollywood in a bad light, I won't want to be a movie star. It just makes me more determined than ever. Me too, Bridget exclaims. I can't even let my mother see I'm reading it. They both laugh, talk about some scene or character they love. I've never read that book. Someday I must. I'm sure I'll learn some basic things that have always escaped me. But still, I have the photo my sister took of me and Raquel that night. It's as important as another one I carry, of Marilyn Monroe and Jane Mansfield. A detective friend took it on a studio lot about the same time Bridget took hers. The two famous sex queens are standing in very high heels and very low-cut dresses facing the camera. Monroe has one around Mansfield's deeply indented waist, the other slid into her enormous left breast. Mansfield has one arm around Monroe's shoulders and the other plunged up her dress into her crotch. Both blondes are laughing uproariously at the joke, their big joke on the world. They are consummate comedians. When I think of their deaths, Jane's like my cousin, Bobby Sue's. I think they were murdered. Someone, the government, despite the world's insistence on the dumb blonde, got wind of how smart these women were. And Raquel, in my sister's photograph, you can see the birthing of a person who must become an artist of her own body, personality, and being. She is deciding in the very moment to become the world's most beautiful woman. She will pay any price for this. You can see any price is worth it. Years later, when I can't remember the girl this story is about, when the world will have changed so much, I'll zip past newsstands and supermarkets and drugstores all over Los Angeles, past two or three, sometimes as many as a half dozen covers of Raquel's midsection, the famous flaring navel, her trademark. There was the letter to the editor of Playboy magazine in 1975 celebrating her navel as the most beautiful ever created, bemoaning the fact that no other woman's belly button could make the writer as horny. The wide-winged shoulders, the flaming bones of her face, the mysterious Raquel, who is Raquel Welch. Photographers know she's had children from the marks on her famous belly, pregnancies being the cause of her stretched navel. But where the children are, where she has suddenly come from, how old she is, who her husband is, will remain manipulated mysteries for years. I will always be sorry she didn't come on as Raquel Tejada, a name more beautiful than Raquel Welch. But in shooting for Hollywood fame in racist Southern California, she obviously had to erase her Latin American heritage, which in fact is Bolivian, not Mexican. In Southern California, anything south of San Diego is Mexican. So I'll read a section from El Nino. A little secret. The section that I was reading from, the teenage section of this book, is called Beauty and the Beast. However, the story Beauty and the Beast is in this one. That's what editors do to you. So I'm going to read just a fragment from the story Beauty and the Beast. Same time, same place, same narrator, same psyche. The thing, being a native of Southern California, you know, there is no literary history there. There's no literary nothing there. And but I did grow up in a town called Ramona, which was named for Helen Hunt Jackson's book, Ramona. Helen Hunt Jackson was from Massachusetts. What's the town where Amherst is? Amherst. She grew up in Amherst. She was a friend of Emily Dickinson. They had a correspondence. And Helen Hunt Jackson went west, got married and went west, and found herself in Southern California. And she became righteously alarmed, alarmed at the Indian situation, the Southern California Indians. And so she wrote a book called another. She wrote this documentary about the reservations. Hopefully it'll come to me before the night's over. And she printed it herself, and she sent a copy. She bound it in red and sent a copy to every member of Congress, and then was devastated to realize that it was having no effect at all. So she then decided that she had to do, she had to write an Uncle Tom's Cabin. So she fictionalized a story about the Southern California Indians, and it's called Ramona. So that's the one literary thing that's there, you know. So I've tried, and I did grow up in Ramona, so I've tried to touch on that a little bit. I've also, you know, I mean, even from a small child, I never recognized myself in the movies. I didn't recognize Southern California, and I never have in any of the literature, and in the stereotype of what Southern California is, which rarely has anything to do with the land except for the good weather. That will always be a theme, is trying to somehow write of it truly, that place. Cold winter nights with snow on Palomar Mountain 20 miles above us. He hung around the drive-in stand my father designed and built of redwood, drinking in the bushes with the Indians, tottering back when I came on shift, sometimes bringing me a rose from the alley, and we would talk through the handout windows till closing, midnight, rock and roll from the jukebox, you ain't nothing but a hound dog, the loud cars and neon lights of the small mountain town racing behind this poor soul hanging around me for years, the first guy I ever really talked to. I never realized, I guess, because the relationship carried the onus of force, and because my mother had warned me for years that if you were friendly to guys, they would get the wrong idea. That in a strange way, Lizard became a close friend. The situation before this is that she is forced to go, in order to maintain her relationship with this Indian boy, the Mojave Indian, she has to go every other weekend with a white guy. So that's who Lizard is. I never realized, I guess, because the relationship carried the onus of force and because my mother had warned me for years that if you were friendly to guys, they would get the wrong idea, that in a strange way, Lizard became a close friend. He teased me a lot as I made and wrapped and served hamburgers, French fries, and malts, carried on my painfully tongue-tied, newly developing waitress banter with everyone who came to the windows. He said I was right not to let the doctor break my legs. I walked in a sexy way. He said his aunt, who lived with the Indians, knew real medicine, healing powers in rocks and weeds, and that doctor just wanted to hook us for the money. He called me Blondie and batted around the name El Angel's Heavenly Hamburgers. Customers, especially strangers, always called me Blondie, but I think it was through Lizard that I began to know something about the power and meaning in words, in my own names. We talked those drive-in nights about everything, analyzing the people of our town and country, gossip and politics and religions, Indians and the worth of rock and roll and the meaning of life, evolving a real relationship out of the false construct of my father. When my father told me recently that these days, so many years later, Lizard has a poetry manuscript, a foot thick, I was at first astonished. Ours was not a town to produce one poet, much less two. But then I remember, more in my body than in my mind, how our conversations verged on the creative, on the play and concern with words and ideas and what was happening in the world, and the expression returns rather gently that I once heard from a professor that filled me then with loathing, shame, and rage. Redneck intellectuals. The only thing Lizard and I didn't talk about was Sergey, the boy I fell in love with after Ramon, the sailor I planned to marry as soon as I graduated, the boy who would be the father of my children. I knew he knew about Sergey. Everyone in Ramona knew about Sergey. My father's conditional prohibition in regards to Ramon had turned unconditional with Sergey. I was forbidden to ever see him. Sometimes Lizard's mother came to the window, a small, intense, black-haired woman with a chiseled face like his, except she was pretty. We never acknowledged the woman we shared, her son, who is becoming a sort of mirror for me. He was a boy. I was a girl. He was old. I was young. He was dumb. I was smart. He was wasting his life. Mine was before me. He was ugly. I was beautiful. Everyone said these things. I studied his face framed in the aluminum service window until I found myself seeing through his ugly mask, seeing interesting lines, the jaw and lips and nose and eyes of his mother, the thick black curls over the granite face. He looked like the mime in that other movie I've never been able to forget, The Children of Paradise, the life athlete's body as he walked away under the street lamps of Main Street at closing, so surprisingly, despite its slouch, its depression, full of grace and rhythm and story. Though he graduated from high school and graduates were forbidden, he always managed to get into Elhan Hall, where we had our Friday night dances, the Quonset hut that had once been a real bar and still unmistakably carried the aura, out in the eucalyptus grove on Highway 67, just before the long mountain descent to San Diego and the sea, the long, dangerous mountain road on which our friends, first Porky, then Coyote, were already dying. Today that road is called Slaughter Alley. And this is when I would really get beyond his ugly face, and this was always confusing, my friend snickering as he teeters heavy-limbed across the room to ask me to dance, and I pretend I share their disgust, for there is no way to tell them the strange thing, that when this creep takes me in his arms and I can no longer see him, the stench of alcohol and body odor sending me reeling, and he begins reeling me across the dark floor, through and around the other reeling bodies. The music drinking us deeper into the reservation's bass and bang and piano wail on the floor till he is sobbing in my ear against my neck, his convulsions, some of the first in the dark familiar rhythm I will pursue all my life, the coming, the crying, the birthings, the dyings, the beat of the blood through the organs of our bodies, and I begin to understand the deal my father has made with me. For just as in the movie, the hall is filled with a blaze of light, and the mirror shadows, and the mirror shatters, and I see in the thousand pieces on the floor that I too am the beautiful, awful beast. And, you know, what to do? She's homeless, and so she eventually goes back, and she also loves him, and so. She ends up at midnight in downtown Oakland. If you know Oakland at all, you know it's a very dangerous place to be at down at midnight. Then the long ride through the city in the dead of Sunday night, the bus full of tired and lonely people whose bodies shifted back and forth in a slow-motion tug of war as it stopped and started up again, drone and whine, the rough rhythm, the rhythm of their lives, the larger machine that carries them. When we arrived at the downtown Oakland stop, the bus driver announced the number 80 bus would be 45 minutes late. And then everything I dreaded and feared began occurring. I kept thinking about self-fulfilling prophecy, and then I'd be angry for assuming such responsibility. I was sick of understanding everything at my own expense. I remember seeing, as they surrounded me, the handful of people also waiting for the late bus, backing away from us. I remember most vividly a very sad-looking man on my left and a woman carrying a grocery bag of work clothes on my right, backing far away into the silver marble walls of the Wells Fargo Bank, as I heard one boy say, "I'll bet she'll talk to us when we drag her by her yellow hair into the alley." There were six of them, young teenage boys, black, circling me. From my back, one gathered some of my hair in his hand and yanked it. They circled and circled, spitting obscenities into my face. The violence in each of their young male bodies banded with each of the others, chaining me in a dance of awesome, suffocating power. Sunshine. The name spit from the meanest-looking face I'd ever seen. Sunshine. He kept repeating it. Spit. and his hot vomit and booze breath on my face. He was 15 at the most, his skin exceptionally dark, close to true black, his features smooth and drawn in a pure, exquisite hatred. I saw the black widow spider that once walked around on my bare belly. I'd been fertilizing roses in my backyard, and she had been hidden in the folds of the 25-pound sack I jostled against myself as I moved down the long row and then lay down to rest in the cool grass. When I noticed her, I lay unmoving and watched her wander up and down my naked front, then walk directly to my groin, her long black legs powerful and thick against the flimsy hairs of my pale pubis, the red hourglass on her back too beautiful, too perfect in its contrast to the black. For nature, I thought, that's what evil is, perfection. Before she moved down off the side of my hip and into the grass. At the time, I did not know that black widows, spiders, rarely, if ever, bite women. They bite men, usually in the groin, which is a fact. He spat on my bare feet. And when we get sunshine back there, we's gonna pull every one of them yellow hairs out, one by one. I was becoming grounded in an out-of-the-ordinary manner. Everything was moving in slow motion, and I was struck by many little details. It seemed my salvation lay in understanding everything. And then we'll see how beautiful she is, bald. The leader moved his face, his whole body, even closer. Are you prejudiced? The question was the opening I was waiting for. It made me laugh a little, gently with them. Such a naive question. It made me move my body in a little dance of my own. No, I answered, grinning largely and truthfully at him. I sat down on the bus bench that I had avoided earlier before they came as making me too vulnerable. He sat down on the bench with me, trying to regain the ground he had lost. And when we're through with you, sunshine, we is going to fill all your small holes with rocks. I moved closer to him. I moved closer and began opening myself. I opened every hole, every cell of my body as wide, as open as I could to understand. I asked him his name. Do you live in Oakland? Do you go to school? This question made me laugh again. What a fucking hellhole high school is. Some fucking school deserves this boy. I asked him the corniest questions. I couldn't help it. I wanted to know who he was, who this swarm of spiders crawling over me was, circling me, the flat.